What's up, everybody? This is Cody Pennington from Unfortunate History. I just wanted to give you a quick update about the show. You probably noticed that last week we didn't have an episode, and I want to say I'm sincerely sorry about that. However, there have been some things that come up in my life, including a baby and a master's degree, that have taken up a lot of my time. So unfortunately, at the moment, we're going to have to commit to a every other week schedule. This is because I just cannot commit to it with all the other stuff that I have to do. But good news is that this is temporary. Once things start to lighten up, we will move back to the every week schedule. So just stay tuned for that, and thank you so much for your support.
This is Unfortunate History.
What's up, everybody? This is Cody Pennington.
And this is Greg Skinner.
And welcome to Unfortunate History. This is a podcast that covers the interesting, wacky, and unfortunate moments in history. And on today's episode, we will be covering the unfortunate life of Alan Turing.
I don't know who this is.
I was about to say, many listeners may not know who Alan Turing is, but a lot of people do, and they also know of his accomplishments. And we'll be covering a lot of his accomplishments today, but we'll also be talking about the more unfortunate side of his life, which was his later years. And this will take up the bulk of the episode. This episode probably won't be as long as our other episodes, but I felt like it was a good respite from the awful things we talked about with Unit 731.
the good juicy episodes that are just full of the gnarly bits and bobs. We're going to lighten it up, are we? Is that what this is?
It's an attempt. I mean, okay. It's still pretty unfortunate, but it's an attempt.
Okay.
Now, all of that being said, I still want to talk a bit about Turing's amazing accomplishments. And Greg, you don't know any of them,
nothing,
apparently, but there are some amazing accomplishments. And we're going to talk about those from throughout his life. Now, it's not an exaggeration to say that we all owe Alan Turing a great debt of gratitude, actually.
I think you went a great debt of gratitude.
Oh, no. I can't stop doing it. I feel like I just lose my train of thought and I just end up saying something weird. Something. What's happening to me?
You're making up words. Anyways. It's having a baby. It's fucking with you.
I know. Don't have babies. Like I was saying, it's not an exaggeration to say that we all owe Alan Turing a great debt of gratitude. So it would actually be a crime to overlook the things that he brought to the world during his lifetime. And we'll go into it. You'll probably remember who this person is, Greg, as I go along, but we'll just see.
Okay.
Now, Alan Turing was born in Maida Vale, London.
Oh, so he's British, though.
He is British, yes. Very, very British.
Very British.
Yeah. Now, his father actually had a position in the Indian Civil Service and was also the son of a Scottish clergyman. Now, Greg, I actually wanted to ask you this because I have no idea, but it seems like the UK and India have a very odd history. I'm completely blank on this bit of history.
Oh, really? Well, India was part of the British Empire for a long, long time. And it's questionable on whether the Indians were all that happy about it. But yeah, India was part of the British Empire massively.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense.
We conquered that shit and then give it back.
Oh, that's very, very good of you. Very good of you to hand that back to them.
I'm not an expert on it, but I know it was part of the British Empire for a long time.
Yeah, I had no idea about that. Alan Turing's mother, she was kind of not of much importance other than she was a great woman as a mother. Her family was descendant from the county Tipperary in Ireland. And I mention that to say that the town of Tipperary inside the county Tipperary is a rough, awful place.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, you've never heard of Tipperary?
No.
It's a long way to Tipperary.
Oh, you know. I've heard of it now. Okay. So it's a shithole.
It's a shithole, yeah. Sorry if you live in Tipperary. I mean, I love Ireland, but that place was rough.
Listen, I grew up in a shithole as well. We live in Birmingham. That's a shithole. So it's a lot of it's shit.
Say what you will, I live in Solihull, man. This is like Ritz.
Yeah, you live in Solihull. I grew up in Erdington, mate. It's different.
This is Ritz, Birmingham, okay? We drink our tea with our pinkies out.
Yep, you got the good bit. You got the good. You haven't experienced the shit.
Now, at an early age, Turing was said to show very interesting signs of genius. These signs have been described as the quote unquote personality disorder that leads to such vocations as engineering and mathematics. The person that said that was, I think it was a biographer who said that it was a personality disorder that people that go into mathematics and engineering might show them themselves. I don't think all of them show quirks that we're going to talk about in a second. I don't think they all show these quirks.
So everyone who's ever been an engineer ever just has like a massive personality trait that is a negative thing or something like that. Like, well, are you good at maths? Yeah, you are fucking psychotic.
Well, no, here's a few examples of the interesting childhood signs that he showed that this biographer was talking about. For instance, Turing would sometimes bury his broken toys in hopes of resurrecting them.
No, well, that ain't that bad. Come on.
It's not that bad. I'm not entirely sure why this would prove someone was a genius, obviously. It could be the inquisitive nature of why he did it, possibly thinking people die and they resurrect. Nobody resurrects, though. I don't, maybe.
Yeah, no one ever has resurrected. Sorry, religion. It's never happened, mate.
Now, he was actually also said to have taught himself to read at a very early age in just 3 weeks. Which, that's obviously a sign of genius in its own way.
That's impressive. I'll give him that much.
Very impressive, yeah.
I'll give him that.
He was also very obsessed with numbers. It was said anecdotally that he would stop at every single streetlight to find the serial number on the streetlight. But let's be honest, that sounds like a bit of a handful at this point.
Like, that sounds like autism to me. Was he not autistic?
I think he might have been a slightly on the spectrum, but I'm not 100% sure. I don't think he was ever
a big thing, so.
Yeah, he was definitely either, you know, maybe Asperger's. Yeah, so I think Asperger's is part of the autistic spectrum now, but
it definitely is.
I think he might have had something along those lines, but either way, he was still incredibly high functioning. He was a very, very genius person. I mean, I think he might have just been eccentric, if I'm honest. We'll go on with the story and you can kind of make up your own mind on that.
Okay.
Now, another anecdote from his childhood takes place at a family picnic when he was 7. He decided he wanted to get his family a bit of wild honey, so he plotted the flight paths of the nearby bees until he found the intersection point which marked their hive. And he did bring back some wild honey for his family on this picnic. That is
something.
How old was that? He was 7.
He was 7.
He was 7.
How the fuck?
And you don't. Nobody thinks about bee flight paths at 7. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
No one thinks about bee flight paths on a whole.
Yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know,
for
man.
Bee experts, we wouldn't have figured that out.
And then one final example I wanted to get into of his early genius nature, and more mechanical nature, engineering, I suppose, was when he discovered the chain on his bicycle would regularly dislodge itself from the gears after an exact number of rotations. So literally every single time it reached a certain number of rotations, it was always dislodged. And initially, Turing decided that he would count the rotations as he rode his bike, and then he would stop to fix the chain just before it would dislodge. But on longer journeys, this got a bit annoying for him. So he rigged a mechanical device that would keep the count and readjust the chain itself automatically.
Who is this kid? What the fuck? Okay, he is clever.
I think he was a bit older at that point, but that actually comes back into play in a moment. This whole bicycle thing, it'll come back into play in a little bit later. But yeah, okay. Obviously as a child, he definitely showed promise as a genius, or at least somebody that thinks it, an eccentric thinker out of the box. 100%.
You gotta be somewhat genius to be doing those things at a young age, surely.
Yeah.
To God.
I mean, I took things apart as a kid, but I never like rigged machines to help me through daily life.
I took things apart and then left them took apart. You know what I mean? Yeah, I couldn't put them back together. Like, inquisitive is like just the part of taking stuff apart and having a look, but to be able to, you know, like think these things through. Like that bee thing at the age of 7 is insane when you actually think about it. He plotted the flight of bees. They're bees.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even to think to do that, because I mean, obviously you would probably know that bees have a flight path in some way, but to know to mark out the path of them to find their path back to the hive is pretty intense, considering you'd have to know how bees fly to do that. You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
You wouldn't just say, oh, there's a bee, and you kind of look around. I mean, most people would see a bunch of bees, walk through a field, look around, be like, oh, there's a tree. Maybe I'll go check the tree. Maybe I'll do it. No, he like looked at each individual bee and then fly. Like, it was like he was like an air traffic controller for these bees.
How do you not get stung to fuck? Like, if you disturb, like, he must have disturbed the hive to get the honey. Like, how? I don't know. What is he, the bee whisperer? I don't understand how he's done that.
He probably knew how to do that as well. He probably could. He probably read a book about that when he was 2. Now, during his schooling, he excelled in mathematics. Big surprise. But so much so that Turing's school was actually more annoyed with him than anything. They would have preferred that he studied the classics as well as mathematics and getting a more well-rounded education, because they felt that he was wasting his time in public education if he was going to only learn mathematics. They just said, you have no well-rounded education, so how are you going to know anything about English and all this other stuff and the classics if you don't school in those and you concentrate solely on mathematics? And he said, fuck you. He graduated out of all schools that he went to, but even still, while he was in school, he was still noticed as a genius, even though they were, you know, kind of bashing his non-schooling and non-gaining education in the classics. Like, for instance, when he was 16, he was noted as being introduced to Albert Einstein's work, and he was able to fully grasp the concepts just by reading them out of a book. And it was said that actually he was able to grasp a concept that Albert Einstein had not made clear in his writing. So Albert Einstein had held an idea in his head that spoke on how he felt about the subject that he was writing about. So Turing understood that so well that he was able to infer that from just the writing. That's an in-depth level of knowledge to have on Albert Einstein's work. To have that much depth, to understand it that acutely, is insane. At 16.
And he's getting slated for it by the school.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
In their defense, I suppose, you want to be a well-rounded person, right? I mean, everything that you learn in school is going to teach you some kind of thing that you can add to your personality or add to you as a person. And obviously, he grew up, well, spoiler alert, he grew up to be a very awkward adult.
I suppose when you walk around knowing you're smarter than everyone else, you're going to get a bit of a god complex, aren't you?
I suppose so. I don't know if he was, if he had a god complex or not. I'm not sure.
Not like that, but you know, I mean, you're going to get this in sort of thing where you're going to think, I'm definitely smarter than everyone in this room. And no matter what they say to me, I'll know that it's just, whatever they're saying is stupid to me because I'm so clever. I couldn't have a conversation with this person. I couldn't last 2 minutes with him. It'd tear me apart.
Yeah, see, that's how I feel every time we do a podcast. It's soul wrenching.
That's what you do the research, and I'm just here to
It's soul crushing, man.
Get someone else then. Where's Sam? Get him back.
Yeah. Well, just a quick
Yeah, Sam.
Well, just a quick note, most of Alan Turing's education in his later life occurred at the Sherborne boarding school, which we'll return to a little bit later in the story, but we're going to go ahead and leave that moment, or leave that time in his life for a bit. Now, after he left school, he attended King's College, Cambridge, where he continued his studies in mathematics. Now, interestingly enough, he originally applied for Trinity College, Cambridge, which was he thought was the center of mathematics research, and he had applied there a couple of times, and he failed the exams to get in, which was odd.
What, in maths?
I don't know if it was in maths or not, to be honest. It couldn't have been in maths. It had to have been some kind of general thing, and for them to say that you have to prove your intellectual ability, and maybe he just wasn't well-rounded enough to get in to, I don't know, maybe. That blows my mind that he failed the courses or the exams. But he still got into Cambridge, obviously.
I was going to say, I thought Cambridge was the big daddy university. I thought that was the one you'd want to get into.
So Cambridge is split into multiple colleges. So you've got King College, Trinity College, and all this. You apply for those colleges, and those are part of the Cambridge University. So like if you went through Trinity College, I think Trinity College now, I might be wrong, they might have the largest funding by far of all of the colleges. And you go there and you can apply for scholarships into your Cambridge education. But they are part of Cambridge University. You have to be a part of one of those colleges. Okay. Yeah, it's like a split. It's an interesting setup, but that's just an archaic way that they've done it for a long time. And but he did get into Cambridge. Now, I won't go into a lot of detail on the things that Alan Turing accomplished during his time at university, because quite frankly, I can't understand most of it. I have no idea how to explain the stuff that he did.
Should we just say a lot? He did a lot.
Yeah, he did a lot, but I'm gonna the main points that you listeners should know is that, one, he was obviously a genius, and at this point, he was a flourishing genius. He published papers that were astounding, and one of his papers, which is point two, basically brought in the idea of the first computer, introduced the idea of computer science in general. It was marked as being one of the most important papers of mathematics of all time. Now, the idea in that paper was the idea of a universal machine that was known as the universal Turing machine. And I can't exactly explain that in detail what it does, but it was essentially an automated machine that could be used to perform any algorithm whatsoever, any algorithm, no matter how complicated. It was a machine that could solve any of them or perform them.
Would that not be a calculator?
No, because it was a machine more so to be able to follow instructions. So in a basic sense, you can put there's a tape with different characters on the tape, right? You feed the tape into this machine. And on that tape, if the machine sees a one or a zero, it will perform an action.
So it's literally a dictionary definition of what a computer is, isn't it? It's all ones and zeros. That's coding. That's the very first code, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called binary code. Yeah, it's binary code. It's like the basic computer language. So yes, obviously that was the first bit of computer language, was the binary code, the one and zeros and that.
Now, what year was this? Can I just ask again?
Good Lord, that's a great question.
What decade, like, when was this?
Oh, this was in 1930s.
Fucking hell. Okay.
Yeah, 1938, maybe? I think it might
have been. This is like pre-World War II and everything, so.
Yes, it absolutely was, and that will come to play in just a moment. Now, the Universal Turing Machine, the UTM, was essentially, like we said, one of the world's first computing machines. It wasn't a computer, obviously, in the sense that we know today. However, Turing did indeed create computer science and the idea of the computer in a realized way. That's something that he contributed to the world, which we can all see has affected us greatly. I mean, it's unbelievable that amount of influence you can have on the world.
Pornhub,
X-Videos.
We wouldn't have that without him.
No, good old Turin. Yeah, getting in for the bros.
We're in lockdown, got to do something. Yeah. Quang, 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 quang. Quang, quang,
quang, quang, quang, quang. Well, further to kickstarting the computing age, Alan Turing also put his talents to good use. On the outside of World War II, the day after the UK declared war on Germany, Turing reported to Bletchley Park, and this was a station for the Government Code and Cipher School, which Turing had been working for part-time. Now, it was here that he had developed, along with the help of a senior codebreaker, Dilly Knox. They both developed the bomb, or the BOM. It's spelled bomb with an E, so I think it might still be bomb. Not 100% sure. But he developed this machine. Now, this machine was specifically designed to break German codes. See, at this time, the Germans had developed the Enigma machine, which was an incredibly difficult to crack encryption device that was developed for the first time in history, basically, to this extent. The Enigma machine was very intricate in how it sent out its messages.
I may know who this is.
Yeah, well, Benedict Cumberbatch played him in a film.
I know who this is now. It's come back to me. As soon as you said, okay, I know where we're going now. Christ, he always takes me a while to get the old cogs going.
Yeah. Now, don't ask me to explain how the Enigma machine works either. If you go online, you can find great diagrams on it. Basically, you type a letter into the machine on a keyboard, and then it's outputted as a different letter, but that change consistently. So a Z might be outputted as an F, but that Z again will not be an F. So every single keystroke you have will be a wrong key. And it's a very difficult system to crack because the machine automatically changes what letter is outputted each time. Very, very over the top stuff that you can only be a genius to solve, obviously. Now, I can tell you, though, that the bomb, which I can't explain either, it just it kind of reverse engineered the Enigma machine in a way to be able to spit out what things were being sent.
Yeah.
Now, the bomb did indeed crack the Enigma codes. If you watch the Imitation Game, you would know that. So much so, it was so important that there was actually, by the end of the war, 200 bombs in operation. So they fought tooth and nail, actually, to get this bomb up and operational. They had to fight so much that they had to approach Winston Churchill, the obviously current prime minister at the time, and tell Winston Churchill that they needed this thing to work and they needed the funding because the general on the base was threatening to take it away. This is in the film, but it also happened in real life. And Winston Churchill sent a letter directly to the general and said, "You need to make whatever they need happen now."
Yeah.
and he said, "And I want correspondence telling me that it's been done." He said, "You are doing it." And they did it. And by the end of the war, they had 200 bombs in operation, breaking all of German codes. Absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Now, Alan Turing's seminal work during World War II was a major part of the Allied victory. In essence, he was, in a very real sense, a war hero in his own. He really contributed to the victory. That can't be understated. Now, I can't imagine what it would have been like to actually work with him. He was a genius, yes, but I can imagine his eccentricities, like we were talking about earlier, would really irk you when you're trying to prevent the destruction of the majority of the world.
Yeah.
Here's a quick note from one of Turing's colleagues about his workplace eccentricities. It's a pretty good quote, actually. In the first week of June each year, he would get a bad attack of hay fever, and he would cycle to the office wearing a service gas mask to keep the pollen off. His bicycle had a fault. The chain would come off at regular intervals, and instead of having it mended, he would just count the number of times the pedals went around and would get off the bicycle in time to adjust the chain by hand. Another of his eccentricities is that he chained his mug to the radiator pipes to prevent it being stolen.
Fucking hell. With the mask thing, he'd have fit in well today.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
You could imagine how that kind of person would get a bit, just a bit much. Like, you'd kind of want to, like, one day out of the week, you wouldn't invite him to lunch.
No.
You know, you'd...
I think maybe more than one day a week. Just piss off for a bit, will you? You're doing my head in. He's one of them people. Obviously,
yes, you're amazing. You're incredible. Yes, please. All of that's well and good, but I don't want to talk about that stuff anymore. I want to talk about Alan Turing's personal life, which this is where the unfortunate portion of our story really lies.
Which is what we live for.
This is what we live for here at Unfortunate History. Now, during his time working in World War II, Turing proposed to a fellow mathematician and cryptanalyst. I just feel like you want to say cryptologist or something, like cryptanalyst. Cryptologist.
We love making words in this podcast. You know what we meant.
Yeah, you guys aren't gonna check. This was a woman by the name of, I think it's Joan Clark or Joe. It's not Joanne. I think it's Joan Clark. And she said yes, but their engagement was very short-lived because, you see, Alan Turing was homosexual. And although his fiance was said to have been unfazed by that revelation, Turing felt that he couldn't go through with the marriage, so he called off the wedding. A lot of people know that homosexuality actually used to be a crime in England. This actually began under the reign of Henry VIII with the Buggery Act of 1533. This act outlawed all sodomy in the British Empire, and convictions were punishable by death.
That fat bastard.
But,
fat bastard, ruler of this country, fat cunt. But no, literally, there's still places today that do that, though. That's the thing, like, there are some places that just haven't really advanced that far forward from then.
No, they haven't. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's plenty of countries that still have very strict rules and laws in general around homosexuality. I mean, male homosexuality, which we'll get to in a moment.
Oh, is that more strict than female homosexuality?
We'll get into a moment. But I mean, we're not talking about outside countries. We're talking about just the UK here.
If two dudes want to bang, they should be allowed to bang.
You're goddamn right they should. Yeah. Official statement from the Unfortunate History Podcast.
We support homosexuality. All right, equality.
Now, actually, death was not taken off the table for homosexual punishments until around 300 years later in 1861, and instead acts of sodomy were punishable by a minimum of 10 years in prison. Minimum. That's minimum.
That's like, there's people who have killed people and got less than that. Yeah, if a dude wants to blow another dude, it's like, oh, this is risky. Like, oh, this is what's going to happen?
Now, yeah, I agree. It's absolutely ridiculous. Fucking hell, 10 at minimum 10 years in prison. That's insane. Well, 20 years after that, in 1880, another act was made that made any male homosexual act illegal, whether or not a witness was present. This meant that even acts committed in private could be prosecuted in a court. Now, the wording of the act was so poor and ambiguous that it was referred to as the Blackmailer's Charter, because people would blackmail certain men just to claim that they were homosexual so that they were punished for it. And even Oscar Wilde fell victim to it.
Really? So you could just, like, assume someone, like, so if someone was, like, slightly camp, they could be in trouble there, like.
Yeah, the slightest thing that they said, the smallest bit of evidence was letters of affection, letters of any type of affection going to from male to male. But anybody could write a letter and say that it was from so-and-so to so-and-so.
He stood next to me at the urinal and went, nice cock, man, and then prison.
Bang! Or he just wrote it on a note and passed it to you.
Just, nice cock, man.
Letters of affection.
God damn, it is a nice cock, but no.
I don't think it was a urinal then. I think it was more of a trough.
I'll just see it as a funnier image in my head.
Yeah, or a bush. Just a bush inside of a house. It's where guys used to piss. Well, we just mentioned lesbianism a few minutes ago. Now, interestingly enough, lesbianism was never explicitly targeted by any legislation in England. Do you want to know why that is?
Why is that then? Well, because it's hot.
Well, on the one occasion that it was brought before Parliament, it was one time brought before Parliament around this era, at least around this age, the House of Commons and the House of Lords rejected the notion because they feared that a law against it would encourage women to explore homosexuality.
What? What?
They were afraid that the law would urge them to break the law.
What do they think women are? Just like these, like just whatever you say, they'll do the opposite.
Yeah, like that's such a childish way to look at a law. And even further to this, there was another reason as well. They also assumed that lesbianism was extremely rare in the female population. All the while, their wives were likely scissoring hard enough to make campfires.
Building up that heat from somewhere. There was no central heating back then.
Yeah, and if your husband's away at fucking Parliament having a brandy with the boys, you want to fucking get some poon, man.
Get some bush.
Yeah, and I understand it. Totally okay with it. That's, you know what? Lesbianism or gay or whatever. Fine by me.
Do what you want to do, man. Do what you want to do.
I don't understand. It seems such an archaic way of thinking. I just don't
know. And it's still around today. It's still really, it's still prevalent in this country.
It is still around today. I just don't get it. I just don't get it, man. And you know what? Okay, I'm going to make this point right now on this podcast because we are a historical podcast. And I'm going to make this point. And people have said this about when we talk about racism and stuff in history and we condemn the racism and that sort of thing. I've seen people comment, not necessarily on what we share directly, but I have seen these comments of people saying that you can't say that this was wrong because everybody in this time was racist. That's revisionist history to look back and say all this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure you've heard those arguments too, right, Greg?
Yeah, big time.
The problem with that argument is that completely ignores the feeling of the person that's being persecuted against. That completely ignores the fact that gay people never wanted to be put to death for being gay. It completely ignores the fact that black people never wanted to be prejudiced against, never wanted to be slaves. Even in that time period, they didn't want that.
Of course not.
So the idea that you would say, looking back at that and saying racism is bad is wrong, that's literally only looking from the white perspective. And dare I say it, that's racist.
Yeah, it's basically like saying, get over it.
Yeah, well, they, it is what it was, You can't go back and revise that. I'm not revising anything. I'm acknowledging the fact. I'm acknowledging the pain that people went through when they were persecuted against in olden times. That's not revision. They were not happy with the outcomes that they were given. So acknowledging those outcomes is not revisionist history. And that's just, it honestly sounds like it's just an excuse to back up an archaic view. It literally is not. So if that's what you believe, please continue listening because we need the listeners. But just know I disagree with you.
And also, fuck you. And also, fuck you. Keep listening. Like I said, we need them. Buy some socks, but also, fuck you.
Buy those fucking socks, you asshole.
Buy those socks, you piece of shit. You bigot piece of shit. Oh. But keep listening. Don't tune out.
Yeah. You know what? No, okay, so I'm not going to be violent about it, but if you think that way, I would urge you to reevaluate your stance and at least think about it from a different perspective.
Get educated and modernize yourself.
Or, you know, not even modernize. Just understand the situation from a different point of view. You know, don't have empathy just for the white people. Have empathy for the black people, too. And the homosexuals, the people that were put to death. You know, have empathy for the people that were actually hurt. Now that we've gone through this entire diatribe, homosexuality wasn't actually legalized in the United Kingdom until the end of the 1960s, which a lot of listeners, you listeners, will remember from our the Cray Twin episodes when we talked about Ronnie Cray's homosexualness. homosexuality, what did I say? Homosexualness.
Homosexualness.
Which was totally fine, but he was a complete terrible person, piece of shit.
Oh, yeah, and they were potentially riling on one another. Not confirmed, but that's probably taking it a bit too far.
That's a conspiracy theory. That's right up there with...
9/11 was an inside job.
9/11 was done by the deli owners. They didn't like big business. Now, that's a conspiracy theory I can get behind.
Did you make that up?
I did just now, yeah.
Just now?
Yeah. Now, I mentioned a little earlier that we'd come back to Alan Turing's boarding school, right? Sherborne. Well, it was here that Alan Turing actually met a person by the name of Christopher Morcom. And Turing and Morcom shared a significant friendship, and he was described as being Turing's first love. It was Morcom who actually helped Turing move further in his pursuit of mathematics, which the two boys had both shared a passion for, mathematics, and I think... code breaking, anagrams, just wordplay, that sort of thing. Things that, in general, though, it boiled down to mathematics and sciences. Now, unfortunately, this friendship was cut very short in February 1930. I think it was only a couple months after they had met and began their friendship, when Morcom drank infected cow's milk, giving him bovine tuberculosis, which killed him.
Jesus Christ, I've never heard of that, infected cow's milk.
I have never heard of bovine tuberculosis either.
Bovine TB, like that's mental.
Now, the loss of Morcom really shook Turing, and it is not known if he had had many other love interests in his life, up until his obvious engagement with Joan Clark. Don't think they were actually lovers at the time. It's not known if he had any other sexual or just love interests, except for one, Arnold Murray. Now, Murray was a 19-year-old unemployed man. I don't know why I said it like that. Unemployed!
That fucking unemployed piece of shit. Look, we're not against the unemployed either, especially in this day and age.
It's fucking post-World War II, man. Everybody was unemployed. And he was 19. What the hell is he going to do?
Exactly.
But Murray was a 19-year-old unemployed man that had started a relationship with Turing in 1952 when he was 39. So 39... to 19. Pretty 20-year difference, just pretty big difference. Either way, not here to judge, but that's borderline. At least he was legal age. Now, shortly after beginning their relationship, Turing's house was burgled, and the suspect was apparently known by Murray. So Turing decided to report this burglary to the police. Now, the police did come, and during their investigation of the burglary, in some kind of... events, some kind of exchange of events. I don't know exactly what the events were. Turing eventually acknowledged that he was in a sexual relationship with Murray.
Why? Why would you say anything in this time?
I don't know. I don't know why he said it. I'm not 100% sure. It was just saying that during the investigation, it became, it was acknowledged. I don't know if it was even if it was even explicitly, you know, yelled, you know, it's like more of a oh yes, that's my boyfriend, like we were living here, that's my boyfriend, and it's like, oh, you know, it could have been a slip of the tongue, I don't know, but at some point it was acknowledged that he did have a sexual relationship with the 19-year-old Murray. So both men were arrested and charged with gross indecency.
Gross indecency in their own... Just lie! God damn, he's such a smart guy. He couldn't make up a bit of bullshit once. He's my roommate. We're in a band.
It sounds like... it says that Turing acknowledged it, but it could have been acknowledged by Murray, or it could have just been a slip of the tongue, or it could have been just to come out during questioning. I don't know, but yeah, he didn't lie. And they were both arrested and charged for gross indecency. No word on if the burglary was fucking solved. But they were arrested.
It probably went straight out the window.
It probably did.
Hey guys, this is a better charge.
They basically said, this is a get right here. This is a definite get. Like, so we're taking these guys in. Now, on the advice of his own lawyer, Turing entered a plea of guilty, and he was convicted. And he was given the choice between imprisonment and probation, which, of course, you would likely choose the probation.
Yeah.
However, the probation was conditional. He had to undergo chemical castration.
Fucking hell, come on. Pedophiles don't get that today.
Now, what chemical castration does, for those of you that don't know, is remove the testosterone from the body by injecting estrogen. I didn't actually know this myself, but I found out that the sex drive in both male and females is driven by testosterone. So I didn't actually know that, but testosterone is what drives your sex drive in both male and female. Obviously, males have much more of it, and women are balanced out much more by estrogen.
So that's why dudes are so horny.
It is why dudes are so horny. And some women.
And some women.
Now, Turing actually ended up having these estrogen injections of a synthetic estrogen for a full year. This is a heavy, heavy thing to have injected into you for a full year. When you talk about having an overdose of testosterone, like steroids, if you're on steroids for a full year, that's going to cause some insane changes to your body. And at this time, it's very unlikely that they knew how to wean off of this estrogen. I very much doubt that he had some follow-up care that helped him wean down from this estrogen. And because of that, the treatment rendered him impotent and also caused breast tissue to form.
I was going to say, because he would start, like, he's genetically, he would start looking more feminine from that big time. Like.
Yeah, he did end up growing breast tissue, which is just fucking awful.
It's the same when you see female bodybuilders who take too much testosterone with steroids. They do start getting male features, essentially, like the strong jaw, big broad shoulders. Like, it goes the opposite way. If you're injecting a guy with estrogen, it will generally change your very makeup, you know what I mean, like, of who you are.
Absolutely. It's very, very terrible. Now, along with his body changes, Turing lost his security clearance. He was barred from continuing any cryptographic consultancy for the government, and he was also denied entry into the United States.
He probably was one of the main instigators of winning the war, if you actually think about it. Who knows what we'd be if we hadn't cracked his code?
And he thought of the idea of the computer. This guy invented what these fuckers are using now to write these laws. He invented the machine to do it, and he was literally barred from going into another country, a very first world country, just for being gay. So eventually, this obviously, for as it would for anybody, it became too much, and Alan Turing decided to end his life. He was found on the 8th of June 1954 by his housekeeper, dead at the age of 41. And there was an inquest into his death that determined he had actually committed suicide. His cause of death was established as cyanide poisoning. Now, near his lifeless body was a half-eaten apple. And although this was not tested for cyanide, it was speculated that this was how Turing had consumed the fatal dose of cyanide. Multiple biographers have speculated that he was reenacting a scene from his favorite fairy tale, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He had apparently taken a very keen pleasure in the scene where the wicked queen dips her apple in poison, which is awful.
It's almost eloquent, you know. It's almost artistic.
It is, but
in a horrible way that he actually felt the need to do that purely based on sexuality.
That just blows my mind.
It was a little bit hard. It was a little bit hard work to work with, but fucking hell, you're taking someone just again. It's with the argument today. Like people, you don't pick your sexuality. You know what I mean? Like you're born with it, and that's what it came to for him. That's what it came again for all the things he did. They couldn't look past it. You know what I mean? Then
you know that a lot of these lords in the House of Lords and MPs in the House of Commons, and you know all of these people were buggering men, not all of them, but some of them were buggering. Well, we heard that one of the guys had a sexual, one of the person people in the House of Lords has a sexual relation with Ronnie Cray.
Exactly.
Sexual relationship with Ronnie Cray. So, fucking hell, man. What a narcissistic, self-righteous way to look at the world. I mean, how terrible of a thing to do, especially to somebody who literally some of these people owe their lives to.
Big time, a lot of us probably owe our life to him. Again, we may not have won the war without cracking the Enigma code. We may not have won.
Which we'll mention it in a second.
And yet he decided to, he felt the need to kill himself because of how he was treated by his people. It's disgusting.
Yeah. Now, following his death, the British government actually apologized for the mistreatment of Alan Turing. Although, that was not until 2009. And I think it was David Cameron that was the one to do it.
Well, it's no fucking good then, is it? He's already offed himself how many years back?
Well, even worse than that, he was posthumously pardoned in 2011. Pardoned for being homosexual, for breaking the law in 2011. Although, actually, it was a really big fight to get that to happen. They brought there was one specific MP that brought forward an act or legislation or a bill, actually. It was a bill just to bring in the pardoning of Alan Turing. And the argument basically was that in the time he was guilty of a law, and which is obviously incredibly harsh to say and very insensitive to say, but it was also followed up with the statement saying it's important that we realize what the laws were so that we can progress from them as opposed to going back and trying to change them. But eventually that idea was struck down, so that it culminated in the development of the Alan Turing Law, actually, which serves as an amnesty law, which retroactively pardons men who were cautioned or convicted of homosexual acts. And I think that's straight up until the Buggery Act under King Henry VIII. So there was something out of that, but it is no good for Alan Turing, obviously.
Considering a lot of the people who had been charged with that were probably dead by then anyway. Did he at least get, like, a medal?
He did get a medal. Yeah, he got a medal at his childhood home where he was born. And on the medal, it was a code-breaking medal. And I think it's still there today. It's a plaque with his name on it saying that he was the code-breaker for World War II. It's a blue plaque. I think everybody that was part of the team might have gotten one. But he was recognized for his contribution to the war.
He should have got a special one, though, like a better one than everyone else. He did crack it by himself.
Well, there's also an Alan Turing organization, I believe, that does does a lot of good. There's a lot of stuff for him that supports him posthumously. So, yeah, it is unfortunate. I mean, obviously, like what we're talking about. But it is unfortunate that he didn't get these things while he was alive. But
I know.
It's terrible.
At least something came from it, though. At least it was recognized later on.
Well, also, to be killed in such a way, I mean, yes, he committed suicide, but that's a long, drawn-out process to be chemically castrated just for being yourself. That's terrible.
Imagine what your hormones are doing at that, what it's doing to your mental health as well when you've been pumped full of the opposite hormone of what you're meant to have going through your veins. It's going to fuck you up. Big time.
Even that point, if he were to have Asperger's, I mean, I can't imagine the effects it would have on somebody that was high functioning like he must have been. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
It must have been like a long drawn out form of torture, that sort of stuff.
100%. Might as well have taken the imprisonment.
Yeah, but again, at the time, you wouldn't think that way, would you? You'd think, oh, I don't want to go to prison. I'll take this then. But I bet in the long run, he wishes he'd gone to prison.
So there you have it, a story of an amazingly talented man whose incredible achievements and skills played a pretty pivotal role in saving thousands, if not millions, of lives. And then it was kicked out from under him just because of who he slept with. Alan Turing, honestly, he could not have chosen who he found attractive, just as I can't control being attracted to big butts and Greg can't control being attracted to short women. And yet... His lifetime of accomplishments were taken away from him, stolen like he was worth nothing. But you may well owe your life to Alan Turing. You, listener, you might. You at least owe him for the device you're using to listen to this episode, at the very least. And he deserves so much more than he received, and still deserves even more than that. And that, I think, is what's truly unfortunate.
There's my clap for him. There's my clap for him.
Fucking Alan Turing, man.
Alan Turing. What a G. What a G.
What a shitty world we live in. But at least it gives us topics to cover. So,
in about 5 years' time, if we're still doing this podcast, we'll cover 2020.
Yeah. We do need to set a limit on how far back we're going to go, because I have a lot of topics that are from like 2016 that are really juicy, but I don't want to do them because I feel like that's not history. It is history, but it just doesn't feel like it.
We have to give it 5 years. If it's past half a decade, we can cover it.
Okay, 5 years. I can agree with that. You heard it here, folks. We finally decided on episode 26 that we will be setting a limit on how far back we can go.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. If you want to follow the podcast, please just Google Unfortunate History. Definitely sign up to our newsletter. Please do that. If you do not mind, please sign up to our newsletter. It would really help us out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you want to follow me, just Google Cody Pennington. Greg?
Again, I'm still gskin93 on Instagram. That's how you will find me.
There we go. Well, with that said, unfortunately, we gotta go. So stay unfortunate.
Stay unfortunate, guys. Ta-ra.
Bye.